You found the number one internet site for irreverent, cool, and entertaining talk programming. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.
You're listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. Start your workday off right with the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Thank you, Linda O'Brien. This is Maria Sanchez, and good morning. Welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show, heard weekdays at latalkradio.com live, and later on, podcasts available for download to listen on demand and on iTunes at mariasanchezshow.com and themariasanchezshow.com. Thank you for joining us if you're listening to us live, and if you're listening to us not live, thank you for joining us too. Okay, we've got a big program planned for you this morning. We are visiting with our medical correspondent, Dr. Mike Applebaum. He's going to be talking with us about the Angelina Jolie story, about the elective preventative double mastectomy that she revealed last week, and also that she's going to have her ovaries taken out. He's going to speak with us about that. We have about, I think, a dozen and a half correspondents who visit with us when their field of expertise comes into the news. So that's how Dr. Michael Applebaum will be visiting with us this morning. Later on in the program, we have the world's only astrosexologist, Kiki T. She's visiting with us. She does so monthly because that's when the sign of the zodiac changes. She tells us what's in store for the next sign. And then finally, we are rounding it out with Father Craig Cox, who's the rector and president of St. John's Seminary here in Southern California. He's going to be speaking about a workshop that they're having called Life is Changed. And it's for Catholics and non-Catholics alike. So we're covering the spectrum, I guess you'd say. So obviously in the news is the horrible two-mile-wide tornado that tore through the town of Moore outside of Oklahoma City yesterday afternoon. They have downgraded the number of people who were killed to 24. That's right as we went on to the broadcast. But President Obama has declared it a major disaster area in Oklahoma, ordering federal aid. The town has about 50,000 folks in it. The National Weather Service assigned the twister a preliminary ranking of EF4, which they've been talking about. That's the second most powerful category of tornado, with winds up to 200 miles per hour. EF5 is the worst. That means it has winds over 200 miles per hour. That stands for Enhanced Fujita Scale. So this is the deadliest tornado that's been through the area since May 3rd, 1999. And there was another one in 2003, but not as horrific as this one. And obviously May is tornado month because the 1990 tornado in Oklahoma was the third costliest tornado in U.S. history, causing more than $1 billion in damage at that time. Or they say today's dollar would make it $1.3 billion. The Joplin and Tuscaloosa tornadoes in 2011 were more costly. I am a volunteer with the American Red Cross. I am a spokesperson for the American Red Cross, and I have had the honor and the privilege to be involved with the American Red Cross since 2008. I actually was an employee first. I was the director of development and communications at one of the chapters here in Southern California. And then I left for professional reasons, but I've remained a volunteer ever since. I've been deployed on disasters, and the Tuscaloosa tornado disaster in 2011, I was deployed in May of 2011. It hit, I believe, on Friday, and I was asked Friday night, I think, to deploy. And when you put your name on the availability list to deploy, when you get the call, you're supposed to be able to leave within 24 hours. So did that, landed, and when you're going to a national disaster area, you can imagine that everything's affected. So the infrastructure is affected, the power is affected, and there is a scarcity of places to be. So that Tuscaloosa tornado was no exception. So when I landed in Tuscaloosa, we had on our Red Cross, polo shirts. And that's how we identified one another in the airport, because we don't know each other. We're from all over the country. And we get into groups of four or five. We rent cars to get to where we're supposed to go. At that time, we were told to go to a campus in Birmingham, which then I got deployed to Tuscaloosa after that. So I slept in a basketball gymnasium with 400 other volunteers on cots. Didn't know I was supposed to bring a pillow, so I rolled up. I think I brought a towel, or I went and bought a towel. I can't remember. Rolled that up and used that as a pillow. The Red Cross has blankets, of course. And then Tuscaloosa, we had a shelter set up. So the American Red Cross is responding, as they always do, to this tornado disaster in Oklahoma. They're all over the news this morning, which makes me really proud, because they, while mandated by Congress or chartered by Congress, they are not government subsidized. So the American Red Cross, with all of its humanitarianism, can only do what it does through donations. And so in order to donate, what you can do is you can either log on to their website, which is redcross.org. You can call 800-RED-CROSS, or the easiest is you can text Red Cross to 90999, and that will take a $10 donation. One of the other amazing things about the American Red Cross is that 91 cents out of every donated dollar goes to services. So lean, mean, fighting machine. So when you give money, it's going to what they do, which is at this point in time, food, shelter, and comfort. So they have, excuse me, two shelters open. They've got more ready to be open as the need may arise. And they are bringing in their emergency response vehicles, a couple dozen of those. What those do is that allows us, the American Red Cross, to get to where the clients are, because sometimes people are not able to get around, one, because there's no transportation, or two, because there's power lines down and it's dangerous, or three, because they don't know where to go. So the emergency response vehicles can feed up to 5,000 meals in a day out of their units. So those are being deployed from all over the country, coming to help the folks in more Oklahoma. And then they're going to be providing comfort kits and cleanup kits. So the comfort kits are your basic necessities, like your toiletries, toothbrush, soap, washcloth, comb, mouthwash. They even, for the little ones, they'll have blankets and like stuffed animals and all that sort of thing. The other thing about the American Red Cross is that there are other sister agencies, if you will, or mutual aid agencies that take donations other than financial. The American Red Cross doesn't do that for a couple reasons. So you can give to other, if you have, say, shoes and clothing and blankets and stuffed animals and stuff, you can give that to other agencies. The American Red Cross takes cash because we give brand new things to clients. They said, especially like in the middle of the night when we go, if there's been a single family home fire, and we're helping that family get acclimated to a motel in the area and to a debit card where they can get some meals, they say that it helps them with their dignity and the trauma that they can go to a store and buy new clothing instead of putting on somebody else's previously worn items. Not that those items don't have a function at other times, but that's just, I just wanted to explain to you what the reason is about that. So obviously the recovery is ongoing. They've got search and rescue out there. They've got cadavers out there. They've got the National Guard out there. Federal Emergency Management Agency has been activated. That's FEMA. The FAA imposed a temporary flight restriction that allowed only relief aircraft in the area, saying that it was at the request of the police, who needed quiet to search for the buried survivors. They have heat-seeking thermal imaging out there. Having been in Tuscaloosa after that tornado in 2011, it is unbelievable how when it lands, it just churns up everything in its path. It sucks it up and spits it out and puts it into piles of tinder. And you'll see things. I remember walking through the devastation, and you'll see a shoe, you'll see a stove, you'll see a car, you'll see an American flag. There's nothing else that's recognizable. And then across the street, unscathed, undamaged, untouched, it's just amazing how random it is when it hits down. So that's the top story of the hour. Other than that, Jodi Arias is supposedly going to be addressing the jury in about 20 minutes, and as to whether or not she can talk herself out of getting the death penalty. Share a few things with you before we talk with Dr. Michael Applebaum. They say that only one woman has ever been executed in Arizona, and that is a one-time Alaska cabaret singer. She was convicted of killing a wealthy Tucson chicken farmer. She was hanged and accidentally decapitated in 1930. There are two women and 122 men currently on death row in the state of Arizona. Of the more than 1,300 murderers executed nationwide since 1976, only 12, or that's less than 1%, were women. So less than 2% of death row inmates are women. Women account for 1 in 8 of the arrests for murder. And yesterday, the judge denied a request for a mistrial in the penalty phase of the trial by Area Jodi's lawyers because they said a key defense witness had declined to testify due to threats, but the judge said, no, that's too bad. So Arizona is among 32 states that have the death penalty. It has executed 11 people since 2010, most recently in December when Richard Stokely was put to death for killing two girls in 1991. In January, a Gallup poll found that the support for the death penalty in the United States was at 63%, down from a high of 80% in 1994. And according to the executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center, his name is Richard Dieter, his quote is, "It's a very difficult thing for juries, even if they are for the death penalty, to impose it on an individual, a young person, a person who culturally they relate to. You lift some onus from them by saying, give it to me." And he's referring to the interview that she did right after she was convicted of the cruelty of the crime. So we have our live raw radio. We're calling Dr. Michael Applebaum right now, and he's going to speak with us about the Angelina Jolie step that she took.
Good morning.
Good morning, Dr. Applebaum. Thank you for making yourself available to the Maria Sanchez Show.
It is my pleasure, and good morning to your audience.
Yes, good morning. So we wanted to speak with you as our medical correspondent about your opinion on what Angelina Jolie did with her elective, quote, preventative double mastectomy because she has the gene, do you say BRCA1 or BRCA1?
Either way. BRCA just seems a little bit more cumbersome. Most people say BRCA.
BRCA, okay. So first, for folks who don't know what BRCA1 is and or how and why you're tested for it, maybe you can just give a little brief overview of BRCA1 and BRCA2, why
sure.
They're important to know about.
Sure. BRCA1 and BRCA2 are actually normal things. And what they're known as is tumor suppressor genes. They produce a protein that helps prevent cells from getting sick and growing too rapidly or in an uncontrolled manner. So if you think of what cancer is basically cells that are growing without control. They've somehow lost whatever the regulatory mechanism is for them, and they're out of control. So what BRCA1 and 2 basically do is repair cells that have divided and didn't divide properly, that the information that went from one cell to the next, you know, our cells are always dividing, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's how we rebuild our tissues. And sometimes the information that is transmitted from the mother cell to the daughter cell is actually not accurate. So BRCA1 and BRCA2 fixes the problems. You know, it's a spell checker, if you would. And when those things don't function properly, as in the case apparently of Angelina Jolie, then the repair does not take place. So the cells don't know how to regulate themselves properly, and you end up with a higher likelihood of cancer.
Now, cancer in general or the specific cancers that she speaks of, breast and ovarian?
No, there are specific cancers. So BRCA1, for example, is associated, and when I say BRCA1, I'm talking about an abnormality in BRCA1. Is associated with ovarian cancer, breast cancer, fallopian tube cancer, male breast cancer, which is more prevalent with BRCA2, incidentally, and cancer of the pancreas.
And so when you get tested for this and you find out that it's unstable, I guess, or you, as you said, genetically it's
mutated.
Mutated. Then you know that you have an imbalance in your system.
Well, yes and no. And here's one of the problems with testing. It's not as if it's digital. You know, it's either bad or good. One of the problems is that there have been already identified more than 1,000 mutations in BRCA1 alone. So it really depends on the particular mutation and whether that mutation is going to have a harmful consequence. To the best of our knowledge, not all mutations are harmful. This whole thing is a boon for genetic counselors, no doubt about that.
And the test itself.
Yeah.
Which I understand is fairly pricey.
Well, you know, there's a lawsuit around that. It turns out that the company that developed the test basically has a stranglehold on it. And they're trying to wrestle it, because one of the problems is that if you test positive for BRCA, there's no way to double check the testing, right? Because the same company that tested you positive is going to test you again to see if you're positive. So it's created a little bit of a stir in the medical communities, which spilled over into the legal communities. And to the best of my recollection, right now it's actually made its way up to the Supreme Court, whether or not they can continue their monopoly on this particular test. But it is fairly expensive, and my guess is it's about $3K. To me, that's expensive. And I think that once, if there is competition in testing, then clearly, like in all instances, pricing will go down.
And I understand that it's not necessarily covered by insurance.
That is correct.
So it's...
That's correct.
I guess
it's like
be...
everything else. You know, it depends on the policy that you have. Certain things are going to be covered, certain things won't. And it's also interesting to realize that this isn't something they just get from your mom. Either parent can transmit the BRCA1 abnormality and BRCA2. It can come from your dad as well.
So in my situation, which my mother had her right breast removed in June, it'll be 6 years next month. She's never done any testing about that. She's still alive. She's surviving, albeit limping along. Is this? I've been sending her all these articles lately and saying, Mom, I think you need to be tested, because one, she's the one that had the breast cancer, and two, she would be the one that then might be the indicator that my sister and I should get the test. What's your feeling on that?
Well, first of all, there are no hard and fast guidelines for who should or should not be tested. And even though there are some that have been promulgated, they're not exactly agreed upon by everybody. But if you have a first-degree relative, which your mom would be to you, for example, and she only has a breast cancer in a single breast, then the likelihood that you would be a candidate for testing is slim. In general, they would prefer to test the individual who has the cancer to see whether she, in this case, because it's a woman's breast cancer, is carrying the BRCA1 gene abnormality. But one way that if you're interested in doing it, that you could leverage it, which is probably one of the more interesting things about this BRCA1 gene, is that a study was done in 2007, and it was published in JAMA. And I'm going to make a leap here and just say that perhaps somewhere flowing in your veins is some Hispanic blood.
Yes.
And, somebody's got to be brave about this stuff, Maria. So this 2007 study was interesting because they compared BRCA1 incidence in five different ethnic groups. And actually, there is a higher carrier prevalence in Hispanics than, let's say, compared to African-Americans or Asian-Americans.
Really?
But the belief is because of unrecognized Jewish ancestry in the Hispanic population. And without getting into the Inquisition, Muranos, auto de fe, and other stuff, it turns out that there are many people of Hispanic extraction who actually have Jewish ancestry, and the BRCA1 abnormality has a remarkably high incidence in Ashkenazi Jews. So if you can trace your, you know, you could do the who do you think you are kind of thing. And if you could trace your ancestry back to a Jewish heritage, then there would be a reason to get tested for BRCA1, because a first-degree relative of yours has a breast cancer. Otherwise, there's probably not really any good reason, statistically speaking.
But I was thinking, if it started with my mom, and because she had her right breast removed, and she's still alive. If she tests negative, then there's even less concern, I would imagine, for my sister and myself.
That is correct. There would be less concern if she tests negative, although I guess it's possible that you could have received it or your sister could have received it from your pop and mm-hmm. have no way of knowing because nobody's sick. But there's always that possibility. The likelihood is extremely slim.
So now the story is this week that Angelina Jolie is going to have the preventative removal of her ovaries because
right.
of the BRCA
right.
mutation.
And I would actually be surprised if it stopped there. I don't think it's going to be her ovaries. I think it's going to be her ovaries, her fallopian tubes. And more likely than not, I suspect they'll at least offer to take out her uterus.
Mm-hmm.
Because once your ovaries and fallopian tubes are gone, your uterus really doesn't do a whole heck of a lot for you unless you're going to become a surrogate mom or something like that. And I suspect that renting Angelina Jolie for 9 months is expensive, and most people would go a cheaper route. So I think that you'll probably get everything removed. Remember, with BRCA1, the incidence of fallopian tube cancers is increased, so why not? And the uterus, because it's going to be rendered relatively useless, is probably going to go as well. That's what I think will happen.
Is that considered then a hysterectomy?
Well, it's a hysterectomy, it's an oophorectomy, and it's a self-injectomy. Because the scalpinx is are your fallopian tubes, the oophorus is your ovary, and your hysterectomy is your uterus, your hyster.
And since
all those things go away.
And since she's only 37 years of age.
Well, 38 on June 4th.
Okay.
We have to have a birthday celebration.
And how is it that you know that?
Because I want to see if she was 37.
Okay.
Really. And the reason I looked that up, for the heck of it, is that she had options. She did not have to have her mastectomies. And I'm wondering why it is it was done. You know, she had this nipple delay procedure. She chose to have mastectomies. If you go into the surgosphere and read what people are writing about this stuff, the nipple delay is a relatively uncommon procedure, and most people believe it was performed because she probably, or they believe that she may have had breast augmentation surgery or something like that. Which may cause compromise to the blood supply of the nipples. So this is one way of trying to beef up the blood supply so you don't end up losing your nipples when you have a mastectomy for non-cancer reasons, because this is an elective choice. So I thought I'd see what other options were available to her. So, for example, why didn't she go with, let's say, taking tamoxifen,
mm-hmm.
which has been shown to prevent the development of breast cancer? And there are some reasons not to take tamoxifen with a BRCA1 abnormality because it's apparently not as effective according to certain populations, which means that when you do these studies, you know, you can only do your studies on the population that you have at your disposal. It's not like you could bring in the entire population of another country and see what their responses are to stuff. So there's controversy as to how aggressive these tumors are. There's controversy as to how to treat these things. But she did have the option of doing tamoxifen and having mammograms. And that way, the worst that she would have suffered maybe is the early detection of a cancer where she might have just gotten away with a lumpectomy instead of, let's say, a total mastectomy. Right? I mean, there were choices to be made over here. And in some ways, the representation to the population at large is that if you have this BRCA1, instead of doing these other options, what you do is you have your breast removed. That could be considered an extreme remedy when you can actually do things like monitor and see what happens. So the monitoring that they recommend, it really depends on your age. So younger people, they say you should probably have a combination of mammography and MRI imaging where you alternate, as opposed to older individuals where they just suggest having mammograms because the radiation dose over time can actually help increase the likelihood of developing cancers.
Well,
so to get back to your original point, I wanted to find out her age to see whether she had the option of doing all mammograms at her age or whether it was mammogram and MRI and whatever. So that's why I know her birth date. I wasn't planning on celebrating.
And
the long answer to a short question. Sorry.
It's okay. The thing about the mammogram, which I go annually for mine, and now I guess they're suggesting every other year is fine. But my mom had a mammogram within, it was less than 6 months before she detected the lump. So
that's possible. I don't know how to respond to that. I mean, if you know, if it was a huge lump that was, you know, 10 centimeters and they missed it the one before, then I don't know what to say. But you know, clearly the reason you do screening tests is to try to catch something as early as you possibly can.
Right.
And it is not unreasonable to say that on day X, nobody saw it. And on day X plus 6 months, it became large enough for somebody to see. That mm-hmm. seems a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
But in some ways, what Angelina Jolie did, you know, one person can interpret this as being dissing screening mammography or MRIs, because why not just go through that instead of going through the more radical procedure?
Well, your supposition, though, too, Michael, about the fact if she did have augmentation, then it's not as good either at detecting, right? Because the implants are in the way.
Well, actually, that is the case. If you're trying to sell the service, you mentioned that MRI probably is less affected by it. But according to the American Cancer Society, routine mammography is better at imaging breast tissue than MRI. So if there was this augmentation and that was part of her decision-making, then maybe it pays to make that known, assuming that the reason that you made this whole thing known was to be helpful to the female population, although some men may benefit from it because BRCA2 has a higher incidence of male breast cancer. But that notwithstanding, maybe make that known so people understand that that was part of your decision-making.
Well, and then
I just think it would be a nice information for people to have.
And I agree with you, because it would help if we knew as much as possible, as long as she's trying to represent herself.
Once you
herself
put it out
as,
there, yeah. You may as well put the whole thing out there.
Being forthcoming.
And I'm not of the position, you know, that this was a particularly brave decision. You know, what she did was basically turn in the 87% guaranteed lose lottery ticket for the 95% win lottery ticket. So this was not bravery, in my opinion. And if you're running around getting your career in part bolstered by a breast augmentation surgery, then maybe you should just let that be known, be brave enough to mention that so that women who go through the decision-making process understand that this, too,
right.
may be a factor. You know, instead of following blindly, have all the information available.
Well, and then a conversation that I had with a girlfriend of mine who's also Hispanic, who's a business owner, who's a single mother, she says, you know, great, she can afford that. I can't. I can't afford the test. I can't afford the procedure. I can't afford the best plastic surgeon. I can't afford to take the time off of work. So how is this benefiting me at all? And I thought, wow, that's an interesting spin on the story, because I guess I didn't think it through that far.
Well, I'm not sure how to respond to that either, because, you know, if you, for example, face the need for heart surgery because you have blocked vessels and you're set up for a heart attack, you're still going to miss work. You know, there's still going to be issues. So I'm not so sure that makes a difference. People, clearly some people are better off when it comes to being able to miss work. Clearly people are able to sustain lean times better than others. But whether that becomes the dispositive factor, I can't say. I can't address that.
I think it's because of the elective nature of it versus the medical necessity of the heart example that you just gave.
Well, the elective nature of this was the fact that she went and she got herself BRCA tested. And beyond that, once you're positive for this thing, and again, depends on your insurance. I can't speak for everybody. But once you're positive on this thing, then the likelihood is that there will be some accommodation made through your sick care plan in order to monitor you or in order to see whether these things develop. And it may very well be that depending on what your is of developing the breast cancer and your health plan, you may actually be offered these prophylactic procedures.
And it would be interesting to see if you're tested positive, if that's something that then now follows you, obviously, for the rest of your life and... Well, of course, I guess pre-existing
conditions.
Well,
you keep monitoring. The likelihood of developing the problem is the likelihood of developing the problem. So they would just keep monitoring you.
Yeah.
You know, if that's your choice.
Right.
So,
right.
For example, if you do the mastectomy route, then things may be different, but there's still going to be follow-up. That would be my guess. I can't speak for people's health plans.
And our time is up, but I just wanted to let everyone know that you let it slip in, but one of your favorite sayings that of mine is the sick care system. So that's a whole nother conversation, but I'm glad to hear that you're still keeping that up.
Well, we're a repair and rescue industry. People got to understand it. We're not a touchy-feely group of individuals. I mean, if you look at what it is that we do, we amputate, we exonerate, we irradiate, we inoculate, we medicate. If you tried to pull the kind of stunts that we pull in a professional capacity on the streets of Chicago, you'd end up in jail. If I opened your abdomen one day because I felt like it without your consent, that would be an issue. So we engage in non-touchy-feely stuff. We are not a prevention industry. We are repair and rescue. And the sooner people realize that, they may sooner realize that the responsibility for health care is individual and the responsibility for sick care is what the industry does.
The system. Thank you, Dr. Michael Applebaum. We'll post your contact information as we do every time we speak. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure, and bye-bye to you and your audience.
Thank you. Dr. Michael Applebaum, never a dull conversation with him. He is not only a medical doctor, but an attorney as well. And now we are getting Kiki T on the line. She is our astrosexologist. She's going to be speaking with us about the Zodiac calendar changes. The world's only Kiki T. So she visits with us every month when this happens.
Hello.
Kiki, good afternoon to you.
Hey.
It's Maria Sanchez.
I'm reporting to you from New Paltz, New York.
Okay. Well, I'm glad that you made yourself available. And since it's the changing of the Zodiac signs, that's when we meet once a month to talk about what it is that you have to share.
So the sun is now in Gemini, so we are on our way to summertime.
Yay.
So this is just kind of like the time where it's just like, you know, you get your curiosity going and you kind of figure out plans. And Gemini also rules the sign of short trips and stuff like that. So a lot of vacation plans for the summer kind of get sealed during this time.
And now do you want to speak about Geminis in general or Gemini men since you...
Geminis are like the little Peter Pans of the Zodiac. They like to be really curious and boyish and playful because they have two sides to themselves. So they kind of like to play the boyish side because that can kind of get them to get away with things a little more. But they're charming, you know, so you just kind of have to work with it if you seem to fall in love with one.
I dated a Gemini seriously about 6 years ago, and the poor guy could never make a decision. He was always waffling.
Mm. And they come and go a lot, too. Like, disappearing act.
So,
but, yeah, I think, Gemini is definitely, like, the comedian also, so it's entertaining, so it's like they try to make up for it and stuff, but it can be a little difficult to commit with them. But once they do, it's like you need to be someone that can, like, put up. It's kind of like a two-for-one deal as far as, like, getting a Gemini. So if you kind of, like, you know, having, like, to juggle somebody, then it's for you. But, you know, if you're someone that's just kind of like a one-track mind, you know, about how you like to approach things, then Gemini is something you should definitely stay away from because they can really, they're kind of nutty professors. So it's just like you never know what's going to like happen with them. And sometimes it's not always fun.
So, Kiki, obviously it's difficult for me and many to understand how we can generalize about 1/12 of the population. So,
it's just like the energy that, like, Gemini brings in. So, like, everyone feels it in its own way. So, like, you know, when I was saying, like, oh, you know, people kind of plan trips and do that kind of thing, it's like Gemini rules Mercury. Like, Mercury rules Gemini. So it's, like, about communication. So in everyone's chart, it's going to pick up in different aspects of their lives, whereas Gemini is going to be just like they're going to be expressing themselves more. Cancers, they're going to be kind of like dealing with like people from the past and things of that nature. Then there's going to be Cancers, and so they're going to be a little more social with people. It's just like how it goes around the zodiac. Like, you know, for Sagittarians, it's going to be a time that's going to be more romantic and more about like being in a relationship. For Scorpios, it's going to be dealing with sex and transformation. And Capricorn, which is you, is going to be Capricorn, Cancer, and it's going to be a friendship, socialness, humanity, doing like volunteering and like just being more involved with a group of people, but not like family per se, and not necessarily close friends, which is kind of like dealing with group projects and things of that nature.
So what Kiki just was explaining is, regardless of what the zodiac sign is this month, your sign and how it's affected by this month's zodiac sign has different ramifications.
Yes, and that's how horoscopes are written. So, you know, it's like as all of these transits are happening, the motions of the planet, they move through everyone's chart in a different way. So, you know, breaking it down per sign for 12 signs, this is how I gather my information. So the sun is like a big part of, you know, obviously it's like the 12 big parts of the zodiac that people know about. So it just kind of dictates that part of the year too.
Because, and then there's a lot of naysayers. My sons are some of them. They're like, there's no science to this. Does it have any relevance?
There is a science, though. There is. It's all, you know, it begins at the spring equinox, and then it's not necessarily like, it is the position of the planets, but it's not like longitude, latitude. It's more of like the time schedule of everything. I mean, it's just like, I'm not out to try to convince people that astrology works or doesn't. It's like, for me, it works. For people that are into it, it works. So, it's like, as far as naysayers go, it's like, there's nothing I'm going to be able to say that's going to convince somebody to like something that they don't like. So, I don't care about naysayers. I'm a Scorpio.
So, when you say, for people, it works, what do you mean by that? It works how?
Like, they follow it, and they see correspondences, like, you know, it's like, oh, it's Gemini, I'm having it in my first house, oh, like, being more, you know, it's like having ideas that you just kind of feel more inspired by, and then, like, oh, this is, like, a lucky phase, and then they realize, like, oh, yeah, this is something, you know, just like, oh, this is a good time to go out there and try to date and stuff, and, like, I use it a lot of times for work-related things, too, like, pitching things on certain days, that is luckier for career. Like, you can't, you know, it's just like whether or not in the whole scheme of things this is actually real or I'm just crazy, it's like it works on some kind of level and I understand how it works. You translate it to other people. So, you know, I think it's good stuff.
Now tell folks how you read charts. What are the key factors? What are the salient?
I know where all the planets are at every given time, so I know how to put it onto a chart, like a circular chart, and read it. So there's a science to it, because it's all like geometrical angles that you kind of have to see how the planets interact with each other.
And you do that, what are the salient pieces of information that you need from a person, say a client, in order to help them?
Time of birth, date, and place of birth.
That's all?
Mm-hmm.
Time of birth, date of birth, and place of birth, and place.
Mm-hmm.
And from that, then, what do you do? What do you provide? What do you share? How do we learn from
like
that?
It's a blueprint of like where all the planets are the moment that you're born, and so how they're positioned in your chart can dictate parts of your personality, parts of your talents. I've noticed that like when people are born at a certain time, their rising sign tends to generally dictate their career. People who don't really know the exact time of their birth or they're adopted, like I've been able to help people like kind of sort that out by knowing like astrology, because like rising sign dictates so much of how you are. It's your public persona, so it's very easy to kind of sort that all out.
So if somebody had a cesarean or a premature birth or a birth that was induced, that affects the time that the child is born, which might be different than the gestational time would dictate. And are you saying that
True.
Then that has influence on who they become because of the moment that they were mm-hmm. born, regardless of the circumstances?
Definitely. I mean, it's like the time you come out, no matter what way you come out, is the time you come out. So it's like there's no judgment in how you come out. It's just that is your birth time. So it's not like a right or wrong thing. It's just the time. Like, I have a nephew, he was born 3 months early, and when I was going to see him in the hospital the day he was born, he was meant to be an Aries, but somehow I knew, I was like, I bet you if I look at this chart, he's still going to be an Aries, but Aries rising, because he was born during Capricorn.
Mm.
Sure enough, I looked, and I knew that also because my sister's an Aries, and a lot of times, like, in families, there is, like, a corresponding astrological theme. Like, you know, there'll be a heavy, heavy influence of a certain sign per family. I've noticed there's a lot of Scorpio in my family, so it's like, so I was facing the odds that he was going to be an Aries rising, because my sister's an Aries, my father's an Aries, and he was meant to be an Aries. And then when I looked it up, he was indeed an Aries. And also just the fact that he was like so premature, which is kind of very Aries-like, because they always want to be like first in line. And by him being born earlier, 3 months, he wound up being the oldest grandchild for my grandparents, for my parents, because my other nephew was meant to be born that time that he came out early. So he came out 2 days before the one that was like cooked all the way through.
That is funny. He was so getting the jump,
like,
on everything.
You just can't help it. Yeah. You just can't help it. Yeah. Like, whatever happens, happens, and none of it's bad. It's just different. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like red and blue. It's like they're just two different colors.
Well, Kiki, thank you for your time with us. I look forward to our discussion next month, and I hope you have a great month. We'll put your contact information on our website. Take care, Kiki. Okay. Have a good day.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Kiki T, she's our astrosexologist, the only one in the world. And last time we had her on the phone, she said that her first radio interview was with one of the iterations of my career, which I didn't know at the time. Now we're going to be speaking with Father Craig Cox, who is the rector and president at St. John's Seminary. And we are going to, this is live radio, you see.
Please hold while your call is being transferred to...
There we go.
Maria Gaeta.
Maria is working with Father Craig Cox, and we are live.
Rector's office, Maria speaking.
Hi, Maria. It's Maria Sanchez. We're looking for Hello. Father Craig, please. Thank you.
Sure. Moment.
Thank you. So he's the rector and president of St. John's Seminary, and they have a workshop tomorrow that we wanted to help promote, and it's for Catholics and non-Catholics alike.
Thank you for holding. I'll transfer you.
Thank you, Maria. So it's called Life is Changed Workshop.
Yes, good morning. This is Father Craig Cox.
Hello, Father Cox. This is Maria Sanchez, and you're live on the program this morning. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Maria, and blessings on all of your listeners.
Thank you so much. And we wanted to help get the word out about your workshop tomorrow, Life is Changed. Could you give us an overview of it and why you thought it was important to have it?
I'll be very happy to, and thank you for asking. Obviously, as a believer in Jesus Christ, and we just finished the Easter season celebrating his resurrection from the dead, we Christians believe that death is not the end. And in fact, the title of the workshop is taken from St. Paul, where he proclaims that life is changed, not ended, and we transition into new life. That gives us a certain courage and equanimity with which we can face death. It's something that none of us necessarily welcomes, but we need not fear. It's part of God's plan. And to prepare well for death spiritually, in terms of dealing with family, in terms of finances, in terms of making plans for funeral arrangements, in terms of making choices about what is or is not appropriate medical care, that's really a very virtuous thing. It's to face reality on the basis of faith, and to make good, wise decisions that respect who we are and help ease the burden on our loved ones after death.
So you bring up those concepts, and then you have folks who can speak to it, like the medical intervention, for example. How aggressive do you want somebody to be in terms
exactly. of... We are very blessed on our staff here at St. John's Seminary to have Father Luke Deisinger here. Father Luke is a medical doctor who still maintains his practice, but became a Benedictine monk and got a doctorate in theology. He teaches our bioethics courses, and he can talk about that both from the moral theology, ethical point of view, and from what it means medically as his practice as a physician. He's on the ethics boards of several hospitals, so he's one of our presenters. I do a presentation that deals with looking at Catholic funeral rites and the way that people can prepare for that and help shape within the context of the ritual, what sort of emphasis they want. And then we have both a financial planner and an attorney with a lot of expertise in estate planning who can talk about the kinds of investments, the kinds of charitable gift annuities, how you take care of your family, how you can take care of charities such as the seminary or the Red Cross or whomever it might be, and make wise decisions such that those people who die without will and so on, you know, it ends up being the courts that make the decisions, not the person, him or herself.
Now, Father Cox, do you need to be Catholic in order to attend the seminar?
At least for right now, we are aiming it at Catholics, but that's a good question we've not considered. This is only the second time we've offered it. We're still sort of feeling our way, and we're very definitely talking about Catholic moral theology and Catholic funeral rites. But actually, I think I'll take that back to our planners. It might be that a future version we should aim more widely, but this one is aimed at Catholics.
And how does one avail themselves of the workshop? Because we have time still. It's tomorrow.
It is tomorrow, and I believe there are still a few openings. The easiest thing is to call the Advancement Office of St. John's Seminary. That's 805-389-2036, and put in a reservation. We do limit the number because we want to make sure there is time for some discussion. If the group becomes too big, you don't get that personal touch. But people can make a reservation calling that number. Again, it's 805-389-2036.
Now, what is the time frame of your workshop?
It begins at 10 o'clock, and then we conclude it by providing lunch for the participants. And so roughly 12:45, 1 o'clock is when people could expect to leave.
Is there a fee involved?
There is a $25 fee involved.
And it's on your campus?
It is on our campus, that is correct.
Which is St. John's Seminary in Camarillo.
That is, yes. It's off of Upland Road near the intersection of Upland and Flynn.
Now, you have events that are more general in their appeal in terms of speakers and did you not have Father Boyle?
We did, as a matter of fact. Yes, we do. While the campus is a closed campus as a norm, it is the home of the guys, and it's meant to be a very quiet, prayerful, reflective atmosphere, so it's not wide open all the time. But we have an annual open house. We have a couple of lectures every year to which the public are invited, and that's non-Catholic, Catholic, doesn't matter at all. For attorneys and judges and paralegals, we have the annual Red Mass, and that's where Father Boyle spoke. So, yes, we do have a variety of different events, and people that want to be on our mailing list to learn about that can call that same number. A couple weeks ago, we had our chapel hosted the Oaks Camerata Singers for a concert. We often host a concert or two each year, so we do have a number of events.
And you want to help promote a website too, Father Cox?
You know, our website is under reconstruction and is not very good right now, but people can still go to it for directions. It is www.stjohnsem.edu or just Google St. John's Seminary Camarillo.
And anything else you'd like to add? Because this sounds rather progressive and fairly fascinating to me. I mean, as a Catholic, of course, you're speaking right to the choir, if you will. But just
I appreciate that. I do think that sometimes Catholics fall into that reticence to face death. It's a natural human emotion. And yet, in the fullness of our faith, there's such a beauty to be able to face it, to make decisions that help ease our transition from this life to the next. I see this as a real opportunity, a real grace for people, and by talking about it, it's much better than just kind of hiding from it.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I'm really happy to see our advancements, having been a cradle Catholic and starting with the Latin masses and everything else.
Now, we really need to get you come up here for our open house one of these days.
Yes, I've been there in the years past, but not recently, so I would enjoy seeing that. And we will post that phone number on our website when we post this broadcast later today, so our listeners can reference that as well. That'll be on MariaSanchezShow.com and TheMariaSanchezShow.com, as well as LATalkRadio.com. So, Father Cox, thank you for taking the time. I appreciate it. And thank you for providing this opportunity for folks to, you know, think about the next phase.
You're most welcome. I very much appreciate this opportunity to share this with your listeners. And again, God bless you and all of the people that that you serve out in Radio Land.
Thank you so much. Take care. I look forward to hearing about the success of this. Father Craig Cox, who is the rector and president of St. John Seminary in Camarillo. And as we do every day, we are live from 9 to 9:50 in the morning, Monday through Friday. And then the program is available on the three websites that I mentioned, both MariaSanchezShow.com, TheMariaSanchezShow.com, and LATalkRadio.com in perpetuity. And like us on Facebook. And just a reminder again to text Red Cross to the number 90999 to make your $10 donation. And tomorrow on the program, we're going to have a Red Cross spokesperson speak with us about the ongoing relief efforts in Moore, Oklahoma. Have a great day. Thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to our conversations tomorrow.
Thank you for listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. Live every weekday morning, 9 a.m. Pacific, and on the net at LATalkRadio.com and MariaSanchezShow.com.